Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. And my name is Dick. Stand by a minute. Just want to make sure I'm coming out of all of the computers. At this time, we begin the SecNet as we've done so often for the last 36 or so years. 1982 is when it all began. Main purpose of the TechNet is to gather curious radio amateurs who teach each other an awful lot about the wireless art. How does all this ham radio equipment and other kinds of equipment really work? Transmitters, receivers, transmission lines, antennas, propagation, the 26 different kinds of ham radio. I'm always amazed that this many years downrange, there still are brand new people getting into the hobby who are curious about how it all works. So there's always new ones. Person checks into the TechNet because they do have a question or a comment. Let me drop. By giving us their call letters, their name, and the word yes, which means they do have a question or a comment. You need not to sign in just to say you're listening. After 25, 26 years, we believe somebody is listening. It's interesting to know that there are two other places where you can get some further information about the technical net. One is the website run by KC2NJI, Mike Perry, and that's at the address of amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tangovictor, and there you'll see the last 12 years, I think it's 12 years, maybe even more, of past recordings. So you can choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and listen to past recordings. And people do that who are unable to stay up until this TechNet ends. This TechNet starts at 8 o'clock, usually ends at midnight, 4 hours later. And some people can't stay up that late. But by way of the recording that appears a few days downrange in the week, they can download it to their handheld device and listen to it at a more convenient time. Let me drop it. There's a second website with supporting material for the TechNet, and this one by Mike number 2, K1MJM, and that's at limarktechnet.com, and there you'll find pictures, graphs, articles, and other things that support the TechNet. Okay, at this time we're going to take chickens. By the way, the TechNet is broken up into three sections, I should mention. The first hour or so, depending on the amount of questions and enthusiasm, is people signing in with questions and or comments. The second section is run by Roy AC2GS, and we call that the science and physics section. And the third section is run by Paul WS2N, and we call that the SpaceNet section. And so he's always got some new CubeSats, among other things, that are being launched, new satellites. Roy has got some pretty interesting chunks of science that he gives us. And tonight I'm going to make sure I squeeze in my little puzzle about the why does the bottom of your bicycle pump get hot. And I'm going to do that first before handing it over to Roy. So at this time, we're going to take chickens. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or comment. Try to wait for the beeps in between. In other words, there's four beeps, so if you grab the mic too fast, there's a chance you're going to time out. K2RIW will be listening for chickens.
N2EO Dick with a question.
Rich recognized. Anyone else?
KB2DXC.
Okay, that sounded like Kilo Bravo 2 Delta X-ray Charlie. Correct me if I've got that wrong, and please give me your name, sir.
That is correct, KB2DXC, and the name is Phil at Papa Hotel India Lima, and I do have a question.
Very fine, Phil. Okay, we got Rich and Phil. Anyone else to check in with a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters and name right now. One more call. Anybody with questions or comments for the TechNet, please give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, maybe we're going to have a light night tonight. But sometimes, quite often, people will check in later. Okay, Rich, N2EO, what question would you like to ask tonight? K2RIW in the TechNet, we're listening.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. My power wheelchair, I always assumed it had lead acid batteries. Am I going bad? They're very bad. So I ordered a set of batteries, and they are not lead acid. They're gel cells. I assume the original batteries are gel cells. Barry came over here yesterday to try and get them in. It seems that the battery case was blocking him, so couldn't get it off. So we called, Patty called a friend of hers, a mechanic in Babylon. Hopefully he'll be here tomorrow. But what do you know about gel cells?
I know that the chemistry inside of a gel cell is a kind of lead-acid battery, but the electrolyte is not pure fluid like it is in an ordinary lead-acid battery that's in your automobile. And I think the gel cells are not quite as restrictive as to whether or not they can be held at an angle. They don't have to be completely upright. But when it comes to the total capacity and their life and whether or not they're appropriate for a heavy drain environment like your wheelchair, there I don't know. I hope somebody within the sound of my voice has some more knowledge about the comparison between lead-acid batteries and gel cells. So if I understand you correctly, the original batteries in your wheelchair were gel cells and you're trying to replace them with lead-acid or vice versa. Which way is it first, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW?
I believe the original are gel cells. The replacement are also gel cells.
Okay, so the original batteries were gel cells, and the replacements you bought are gel cells, but they're the same size. You're able to put them into the case. I think you're saying there's something, there's a difficulty that Barry had with putting them into the case. Run that by again, Rich. Go ahead.
Hello, Dick. On the batteries is a case, a plastic case. He couldn't, he said, very tight in there, and he couldn't get them off. We assume now that maybe the chair itself where you sit has to come off. There was an Allen screw. He took it out, but it still wouldn't come out. So he tried tapping with a light hammer. It still wouldn't come out, so we gave it up because we didn't want to break anything. Anyway, I'm going. Patty already called this fella. He used to service her car, and hopefully he'll come over here this week. He wants a garage in Babylon.
The replacement batteries for your wheelchair, were they the exact same model number and from the same manufacturer? Are you trying to do an exact replacement, or is there some kind of a difference between the new batteries and the ones that are there that are giving you some grief? Over to you, Rich, K2RIW.
No, I looked up the model number of the chair. These new batteries are specifically intended for this chair.
So, apparently, the old batteries and the new batteries are the same model number, therefore, in theory, they're physically identical. But I think you're saying the replacement procedure, there's some hidden piece of information as to how you replace the old batteries with the new batteries. And maybe the case that the batteries are in the wheelchair, maybe that whole darn case gets replaced as opposed to just replacing the batteries that are inside. Is that a possibility, Rich? Go ahead.
No, I don't think so. There's a strap that goes over the case. The case is certainly made to be removed. Just that Barry found that it's very, very tight, and he could, there was not enough room for him to get the plastic case off.
Now, your question was the comparison between a lead-acid battery and gel cell. And so I'm wondering why you want to know that comparison. If the original batteries in your wheelchair were gel cells, you bought the exact same model number, maybe even the exact same brand name, which again are gel cells. So you're apparently not switching from gel cell to something else. So I'm wondering why you want to know the comparison between gel cell and lead-acid. Over to you, Rich.
Oh, not at all, Dick. I just wanted to know about gel cells, period. Because I had assumed, incorrectly, that the batteries in there were lead-acid. Apparently they're not. Because the make, model number of the chair, it says gel cells.
ACTGS.
Go right ahead, Roy.
Okay, gel cells is just one of a variation of lead acid. It uses the principle lead metal, lead oxide, and in an acid, the hydrochloric acid, sulfuric acid solution. The difference is in a old standard, it's the liquid sloshing about. In gel cells, it's a gelatinous matrix that's going on. So you can't spill anything, it's safer. It has a couple other little qualities that are slightly different, but the voltages, the current, so all the things that we know and love about lead-acid batteries are identical.
Roy, do you have reason to believe that the energy capacity, energy density, the number of volt amperes or watt hours of a gel cell and a lead-acid battery of approximately the same volume, is there some similarity there, Roy? Go ahead.
Yes, that's my understanding. It's more of a safety feature than anything else. The technology ultimately is almost identical to the old standard lead acids. And you should be able to use one for the other. The only thing is you have to recognize that the old style batteries had a habit of venting, which isn't great. Gel cells, the newer version of lead acid these days. They have about the same energy density as they did before. They're just a little bit consumer friendlier.
So from what we're hearing from Roy and what we've heard from previous transmissions on this subject, previous TechNets, the lead acid battery and gel cell has enough similarity that most likely a deep discharge is not recommended. Whenever you discharge a lead-acid battery beyond the 50% point, you're doing damage. You're cutting into the future capacity in ampere hours of the battery. I believe the instructions with your wheelchair recommended that you recharge it every single night, and I think you had earlier chosen to let the battery drain all the way down to the bottom before recharging it, which we now know is probably a poor choice, and it did probably prematurely age your particular batteries in your wheelchair, and therefore they need replacement sooner than they ordinarily would. I think that's one of the conclusions we came to in the past, that to recharge them as soon as possible is highly recommended as opposed to waiting for a very deep discharge. So, N2EO for further comments or questions, K2LIW. Go ahead there, Rich.
Okay, Dick. The 35 amp hours, 12 volt batteries. The reason is to, it's a 24 volt system. They go in series.
But I think your method of operation used to be to drain them all the way down. In other words, use the wheelchair multiple days and then recharge, as opposed to following the recommendation of the instructions that came with your wheelchair, which is to recharge every night or maybe even recharge at noon and midnight, so to speak. So I think we've concluded that you had artificially aged your batteries. You had put them under a more severe stress by deeply discharging them. Isn't that the conclusion we came to, Rich? N2EO, K2IW, and therefore I think in the future you're going to recharge much more frequently.
Yes. It was recommended to charge every night. And that's exactly what I'm going to do with them, the new batteries. Once we can get in there and change them, I'll charge them right up and use the chair a little bit and then charge it up overnight every night.
Now, one of the gel cells that I owned some years ago did, just by sitting on the shelf or whatever, did become deeply discharged, and therefore it had great difficulty accepting a charge when I tried to recharge it. I remember leaving it on the charger for a very long period of time, like a week, and all of a sudden it came back to life. So what are the characteristics of yours right now? I wonder if putting them on the charger for a very long period of time might help. Over to you, Rich, N2EO, K2IW.
Okay, Dick, I understand what you're saying, but if I can't use the chair, I'm bedbound, so I have to use it. About a week ago, I got stuck on Merrick Road. My attendant had to call the police. We finally got the chair home, and he had to put me in his car. It took so long for the police to show up. We were freezing.
So right now you've got evidence that the total ampere hours is nowhere near what it used to be. That's how you got stuck away from home. You have reason to believe that when you did charge it, by some form of indication, it told you that the charge is over, not to continue charging? Or do you have the ability to charge for a longer period of time to see if you can restore some of the life of those gel cells? So how do you know when you should stop charging, Rich, right now? Go ahead.
It doesn't indicate, but there was a fan on the charger. You can hear it. When the fan stops, I know that the batteries are fully charged, but I'll let them go anyway all night. I can't charge these batteries almost nothing. And when they put the new batteries in, I have to charge them up a little bit, ride it around the house, and then charge it overnight before I can go anywhere.
AC2GS?
Go right ahead, Roy.
It's been discussed a few times on MedicalNet. There are things called battery conditioners. The idea is that when the lead electrode and the lead oxide electrode discharge, they develop a coating of lead sulfide, and those things crystallize and make it difficult to recharge the battery after a while, after deep discharge. So there's different companies that sell conditioning power supplies that sort of pulse the voltages and are thought to help in the desulfonating. So if you have a friend who has one of those gizmos, you might want to try it out. That probably would be somewhat more successful than just keeping a charge on it overnight. But it depends on if you have something like that.
Enjoy, PG.
Go right ahead, Dave.
Did Rich say that Barry couldn't get the old batteries out of the case?
That's pretty much what I heard, Dave. Go ahead.
Okay. The gel cells, when they get old, they expand internally, and the plastic case warps, expands. Unfortunately, all these manufacturers, when they design the case that holds the batteries, they don't give you a lot of room. And if you leave the batteries in too long and the batteries start to expand, as they do when they get old, they get really tight, and it gets to be a problem to get them out, because now the battery has swelled, and it's larger now than it was originally. So that sounds like the problem that he's having. Those batteries are shot. Just take them out, get rid of them. There's no recharging at this point. They're just shot.
I have new batteries here. have to do is get the case covers the batteries. Barry said it was too tight. He couldn't get in there with a wrench or anything. It's just too tight. So I have new batteries. They were $145 for the pair, brand new in the box.
Yeah, according to what Dave is speculating, because your batteries are at the end of their life, and gel cells, among other kinds of lead-acid batteries, will expand, because the your defective batteries that are in that case expanded, and therefore they've jammed themselves into the case. That's why Barry can't remove the old one. That's a guess. Now, was it because you can't remove the cover, or the batteries themselves are jammed in their case, and therefore Barry was unable to remove them? Which do you think was happening, Rich? N2EO, K2IW?
Barry said was it was just physically tight. He couldn't get a wrench in there. That's all.
Yeah, it sounds like he's unable to remove the old batteries from the battery case, probably because the battery's swelling. So next time we talk to Barry, we'll get some further details on that. So looks like it's going to take some heroic effort to remove the batteries from the case where they have swelled into it and made themselves jammed in and tight. And with any further comments or suggestions, give us your call letters right now, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Here, Jack.
Go right ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that gel cells are slightly different from liquid wet lead acid batteries. You got to remember that there's gas generated, and one of the things they do is in a lead acid battery, there's generally a little bit of antimony in the plates. In the case of a gel cell, it's calcium, so that way the gas recombination can take place. Actually, gel cells will charge faster than the traditional wet cell lead acid batteries. And the actual gelified electrolyte really is sulfuric acid, but it's mixed with what they call a fume silica, which makes it like a mass of gel-like substance. So there's a lot of pluses to it, and there's some minuses. You can't overcharge them. If you make them gas too fast and too long, their plates warp, and as you're hearing, the cases get fatter, and cases get fatter due to the heat. So they're really rugged batteries. They have a shorter life than traditional wet cell lead acid batteries, but there you go. K2RW, K2J.
By shorter life, do you mean that the total number of charge-discharge cycles for a gel cell is not quite as big a number as it is with a conventional liquid lead acid battery like we have in our automobiles? So I think you're saying that the number of cycles is somewhat decreased. Is that true, Eric?
Yeah, under normal use with the controlled charging, you'll find that wet plate lead-acid batteries will last about 50% longer than the gel cells. Also, the fact that the gel cells can be charged more rapidly, whereas they only take 2 to 3 hours to bring it up to like 90%. A traditional lead-acid battery might take 4 or 6 hours, depending upon the size and how much you're charging it. So, just remember that you're still moving hydrogen in a gaseous form, but in the gelified electrolyte, it gets recombined again. So, whereas the traditional lead-acid battery, the hydrogen escapes into the air. And one of the reasons why they use gel cells like in wheelchairs is they're considered to be safer because they don't gasify.
Yeah, I can see an advantage of having the electrolyte being a gel-like form in the case of a wheelchair, which is going to, under certain circumstances, experience a fair amount of vibration when you're driving over rough terrain. And a purely liquid lead-acid battery with the liquid sloshing around inside sounds less desirable. Now, where the where the gel cell can be charged more rapidly. I think you're saying that if you've got a properly programmed charger, it can pour a higher number of amperes in there for the first 90% of charge, and then do a trickle charge to top it off, is what I think is going on. So I think you're saying the allowable number of amperes, the C rating, so to speak, for a gel cell, when properly programmed, is a bigger number during that first 90% of charge. Is that what's going on here, Eric? KE2EJ, K2IW?
It's not so much that it's more current, because don't forget, they get hot just like anything else, but because of the gelified electrolyte, because of the gas recombination that's going on within the electrolyte, also the calcium in the plates, they are, let's call them, more efficient at capturing the charge.
So you're telling me the total number of amperes I put in versus the number of ampere hours that I get back out, I get a greater number of ampere hours out to the ratio goes in the case of a gel cell. Maybe the gel cell gives me 90% of the energy back, and maybe a lead acid only gives me 80% of the energy back. Are we talking about numbers like that? So Eric, go ahead.
KB2MAR.
Don't quote me on it. I think the numbers are a little bit bigger. That with a gel cell, you get up to like 80 or 90% in an X period of time, and in a lead acid battery, you may only get, 50-60% at that particular length of time. And it's the chemistry that's making the difference.
Okay, I heard what sounded like Kilo Bravo 2, Mike Alpha Romeo. Correct me if I'm wrong. Please tell us your name and then your information, sir. Go right ahead. K2RIW here.
QSL, you have the call sign. My name here is Gabe George Alpha Bravo Echo. I also like to point out, I came in a little bit late on this particular subject. I don't know if you guys talked about the battery minder, the sulfating apparatus that you put onto a battery and it'll disulfate it. Whether you have a gel cell or an SLA battery or a liquid battery, with acid car battery, it'll disulfate the battery. You guys talk about that yet? Just gave you 2 minutes back to that.
You're a little noisier now than you were the first time you signed in, Gabe, but we're hearing all your words. We did sort of discuss the battery minder and the fact that in some cases a gel cell or a lead acid battery can be restored with a battery minder-like thing. However, the main problem that Rich has right now is that his older gel cell battery that has been overly discharged and mistreated to some degree, we're hearing evidence that it has swelled up so that it has jammed itself in the case. And so now, even though he's got brand new gel cells to replace for the two that are in his electronic wheelchair, it looks like we're having great difficulty removing the swelled up battery from the battery case in order to put the new gel cell battery in there. So we're beyond the point where a battery minder would fix the problem if he's got a swelled battery that's jammed itself into the case. KB2MAR for any further comments. K2RIW, go ahead, Gabe.
Nick, I don't think it's swelled. There's no indication of swelling. It's just that Barry couldn't get in there. It's physically too tight.
Saying, Rich, he was unable to remove the fasteners on the terminals of the battery. He couldn't get his tools in there because it's too tight. Is that what you're saying? Or he couldn't remove the battery because it was jammed. Now, maybe Barry didn't give you enough words as to what his difficulty was. He had the brand new batteries sitting there ready to go in, and he wasn't able to put them in because the case was too tight, so he was unable to remove the terminals because he couldn't get his tools in there. Is that possibly what's going on? N2EO, KQR.
It's physically tight under there. He couldn't get in there, that's all.
if the normal factory service on your wheelchair would be done by replacing the batteries, by replacing them and the case that they're contained in. Maybe that whole module is removed during the repair procedure. Is there any indication in the owner's manual, and does the owner's manual also recommend that the battery service be done by an authorized dealer? Of course, everybody says that, but I wonder, did your owner's manual say words along those lines, Rich? N2EO, K2IW.
There was no owner's manual, nothing. They brought the car here and dumped it on me. Would you believe Hover Round, that's the main name of the car, that's a maker, they only have one service tech, one, for New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut.
Yep. Sounds like a problem. So, you've got a person who has volunteered to try the next step on a repair. Is that true, Rich? Go ahead.
Oh, I'm not sure. Patty used to take her car to a garage in Babylon, which is like 7 miles away. She's going to call him tomorrow and see if he wouldn't come here and do the job. And of course, I'll pay him.
Understand, Rich. Okay, good luck with that procedure. And I can understand how living without that chair certainly limits your mobility. I know you like to drive down to the nearby place that can sell you pizza, among other things, pizzas and bagels and so on. The next person who signed in was Phil. Kilo Bravo 2, Delta X-Ray Charlie. Go right ahead, Phil. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Hey, good afternoon, Dick. This is KB2DXC. It's been a while since I checked in. But I have some antenna questions, primarily about NFED antennas, NFED long wire, NFED random, NFED resonant, and questions about, like, you know, grounding. Do they really need counterpoise? Is there common mode problems, RF in the shack? And then on the tail end of that, if you can maybe talk about antenna mast, metal versus fiberglass. Back to you, K2RW, KB2DXC.
Yeah, it turns out that when you're pouring energy into an antenna, whether you feed it in the center or 30% of the way between the center and the outer edge, or you feed the outer edge, the antenna itself, the resonating, radiating structure, doesn't really care how you feed it. That's your choice. But if you choose to make the radiating section of your antenna electronically a half wave instead of quarter wave, and that times can be very fooling, because there are times when the physical length of the antenna is, let's say, less than a quarter wave, yet electronically it could be a half wave because it's got loading coils and helical winding and top hat capacitors and other kinds of things that will electronically lengthen the antenna. If the antenna is electronically a half wave, and if you're feeding the outer edge of it, the bad news is you're feeding something like a 2,000 ohm impedance. But as long as you got the right kind of an impedance matching structure, either a very broad range antenna tuner, or you've added the right kind of an LC network that steps your 50 ohms up to the 2,000, and then the antenna tuner is feeding the 50 ohm section of that thing, the 50 ohm end of it, that can be a very desirable antenna. It's not popular because people think that they think that feeding a 50 ohm or 70 ohm center of the antenna is a lot more convenient than feeding the 2,000 ohms of the outer edge. Let me drop. But it's kind of obvious that when you're feeding the antenna by feeding the outer edge, end fed, and it's electronically half wave, and you're feeding a 2,000 ohm impedance, I'm talking about the resistive component, is 2,000 ohms. That may think that's a 40 times higher impedance. That's a fancy way of saying the current that you have to launch into that antenna is 40 times lower. The voltage is 40 times higher. Your LC network is going to handle that for you, but the current is 40 times lower. Therefore, your pouring a very small amount of current into your grounding system, your counterpoise. There are a number of people who have used nothing but a simple stake in the ground as the counterpoise and got very high efficiency from an end-fed antenna. Whereas you take a quarter wave antenna, where the feed impedance is something like 35 ohms, now you want your grounding system, your counterpoise system, to have a very small resistance compared to 35 ohms. You'd like it to have 3 ohms of resistance. Well, in order to do that, you've got to have a whole lot of ground plane radials. And so all of that's not required if you choose the end-fed half-wave structure. So that's got some very desirable characteristics. It's unpopular because people think that that LC network that feeds it to step up the impedance from 50 ohms to 2,000 ohms, they're afraid that that's going to be inefficient, hard to manufacture, hard to synthesize, build it, homebrew, or whatever. It's not. It's a relatively simple theory that's covered in the antenna handbook, among other things. Let me drop. Now, the mast that supports the antenna, whether that should be fiberglass or metal, that's more of a mechanical question than an electronic question. And if you have any doubt as to whether there's common current flowing on the outside of your coax cable because of the way you're feeding the antenna or the way it's configured, there's a fairly simple solution to that, a poor man's balance. In other words, by right at the antenna, you make the transmission line going to it, have a certain number of turns of that wire wrapped together, and what you're trying to do is create enough inductive impedance, enough inductive reactance. In other words, you can calculate that in order to create an inductive reactance of, let me pick a number, 1,000 ohms, at some number of microhenries, and by way of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, you plug the numbers into an equation. Let me drop. They've got an equation in the early chapters of the book where if you know the diameter of your coil and the number of turns of your coil, it allows you to calculate how many microhenries of inductance you're going to have. If you've got the right number of microhenries of inductance, that's a poor man's balun. It's an RF choke, and it's it will stop any RF current from flowing down that cable going into the shack. So eliminating current on the outside of the cable. You can do it by the original design of the antenna and understanding what's going on and not allowing it to happen in the first place. But if you don't want to, if you've got an antenna that you're happy with, except for the fact that you've got current flowing on the outside of the transmission line, eliminating it with a poor man's balun is not very difficult. There's ways you can do it in a more compact structure with ferrites, but sometimes that ferrite is a little bit expensive, a little bit hard to get a hold of. The poor man's balun, the right number of turns of a coil taped together with the turns close to each other, and they're insulated from each other by way of the outer plastic on your transmission line, that will almost always solve the problem. There are ways you can measure whether or not there is common mode current and how strong it is on your cable, but we'll get into that on the next transmission if that's one of your questions, Phil. KB2, DXE, K2RIW, go ahead with your further questions or fills that you might need, Phil. K2RIW listening.
Okay, thank you, Dick. This is KB2 DXC. Well, my main concerns come up because my antennas are currently, and the new one probably will be, on the top of a five-story building, apartment building. So actually getting, laying down radials is not going to happen. Ground rod, that's an issue. And then I was, you know, doing a lot of reading in regards to people's experiences with RF getting back into the shack. You know, I got a 100-foot cable run, things like that that I was concerned about. And also the thing with regards to metal versus fiberglass on poles and fiberglass poles being some kind of interfering or interacting with the antenna itself. And I was looking at some of the commercially made end-fed, let me let it drop. You know, you got some companies like Par end-feds, and there's My Antennas, where, you know, they're manufactured with some kind of, I don't know, with a matching network or some kind of a coil or what they would call an un-un with a 9-to-1 un-un on those things. And I was just kind of curious as to if they're pros or cons. I just want to get rid of the Comet antenna that I got on the roof that's a tubular rotatable dipole. It's just a little bit too much to maintain. K2RW, KV2DXC.
Because the impedance going into an end-fed antenna, if it's a half-wave resonator radiator, and you're feeding the outer end where you're feeding the so-called 2,000 ohms, if you were doing it in the field, you could do that with a simple grounding rod as the counterpoise. In the case of being on top of a building, most likely there's a chunk of metal somewhere you can get a hold of that eventually connects to a vent pipe, a drain pipe, some of the steel structure of the building. Any of those things could be a very effective counterpoise. You'd be launching very little current into it because you're feeding such a high impedance. You know, 1/40th of the current, because the impedance is 40 times higher when you're feeding an end-fed radiator. So it doesn't take a grounding rod. Some relatively minor object, as I said, a vent pipe might be a very good a counterpoise for that kind of an antenna. Now, when it comes to does the fiberglass of a support structure or a fiberglass covering over the antenna, does that interfere with operation? I doubt it. The fiberglass is at radio frequencies very transparent. Fiberglass, PVC, and so on. So, and let me drop.
Just concerned mostly about, you know, having, you know, using the aluminum or any other metal for a mast. I'm relatively quite aware that fiberglass should be not a problem.
There are some antennas by their very design. They're intended to be mounted on a metallic mast. And the metallic mast is, to some degree, part of the antenna. And if the antenna is intended to be mounted on a metal mast, and then you decide to mount it on a fiberglass or a PVC or some other kind of insulated mask, you might be significantly changing the design of the antenna. So you may want to read the instructions manual on that one, if I understand correctly. Now, I'm a strong believer in support structures being made out of aluminum, not the tower itself. The tower itself, I think, should be steel if you're putting up a radio tower. I'm not in favor of aluminum towers. But when it comes to other support structure, the nice thing about aluminum is that it doesn't rust. If it's a good grade of aluminum alloy, it handles the weather very nicely. Whereas steel structures, although you get a hell of a lot more strength, properly weatherproofing them so they don't become a rusty, ugly-looking mess, is a little bit more troublesome. Maybe that's some of what you're asking. Over to you, Phil, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, strength is also an issue with the mast. I have on there now that antenna, I believe it's aluminum, or maybe it's a little something a little thicker alloy or something. I think Hurricane Irene just, like, bent it at the where a tape is off when you connect the two sections of it. So, you know, it's lasted a while, but it's seen better days, too. Now, my primary concern, once again, from all I've read about long wires, random wires, I know there's a difference, and everything that everybody has said about their experiences with interference and RF, that I just thought it would be a wise thing to look into what interactions aluminum or any other metal type of mass would do for the issue there. K2RW, KV2DXC.
Yeah, to make a mounting mast strong enough is a function of what is the diameter, the wall thickness, the alloy. You gain a tremendous amount of extra strength of, let's say, aluminum tubing, if you choose a piece of tubing of a larger diameter. Common sense would lead you to believe just stick in the wall and you're going to get more strength. Well, not necessarily. There are times when going from a 1.5-inch diameter pipe to a 2-inch diameter pipe, even though the 2-inch diameter pipe has got a thinner wall, you're going to have a hell of a lot more stiffness and a hell of a lot more strength. So the strength of aluminum tubing goes up very fast with outer diameter of the tubing. That's something worth doing. The mounting mast itself, if it's being used in the recommended way for the design of the antenna, rarely is that a causative agent for giving you a current flowing into the shack, hot RF cable. The hot RF cable is because the antenna is not a balanced structure. If it's a balanced structure being properly fed, like a half-wave dipole with the right kind of a balance on it, is pouring positive current into the right-hand side, negative current into the left-hand side, during this half cycle, and therefore the differential current flowing on the outside of the cable could be done, could be zero, just be by way of the balancing function. But so that's the great advantage of half-wave radiators. But there are times when you haven't got the real estate or whatever to do that. So there's all kinds of ways you can study what kind of antenna you're going to choose, what brand name, how you're going to feed it. But in the worst case, if current is flowing on that cable, it doesn't take a heroic effort to stop it.
Repeater, timeout.
As I was saying, if you do have current flowing on the outside of your transmission line, making that go away is not a heroic effort. A coil of a few turns of that transmission line taped together, acting as an RF choke near the antenna, will almost always eliminate it. And there's ways you can calculate exactly what diameter and how many turns is required to give you how many microhenries of inductive reactance by way of the formula 2 pi FL, 2 pi times the frequency times the inductance in henries will tell you how much inductive reactance you're going to have. And if you make that inductive reactance, let's say 1,000 ohms, then not very much current is going to flow down the outside of that cable. I'll back you for any further fills on all of this, Phil. KB2, DXC, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KB2, DXC. Thank you for all the info on the antenna. I got a few things I got to work out, and I'll probably have that up. I'm going to use a tuner with it. And the next question also was, how close to the antenna does that coil need to be?
You can put the coil quite far from the antenna if for mechanical reasons you desire to do that. In the worst case, if there's current flowing on the outside of the cable, and if the current is only flowing on the first, let's assume that that poor man's balance, you decide to mount it 10 feet from the antenna. And the next 40 feet of that cable goes into the shack. Okay, then you're going to have some, in the worst case, some excess current trying to flow in that first 10 feet. And in most cases, that's quite far from the shack. It's not going to give you any grief. However, because of that RF choke 10 feet away, it's going to be pretty difficult to launch very much current into that cable in the first place. So, it doesn't have to be right at the antenna. Because you've created a high impedance where you've put that poor man's balance, the current that the antenna is trying to launch into the cable, it's not going to be able to do it if there isn't a complete circuit. If the circuit is essentially an open circuit because of the poor man's balance that you put there 10 feet downrange. And 10 feet at most of your ham radio HF frequencies is a very small fraction of a wavelength. Let me drop. The slight exception to this is that if you're mounting the poor man's balun half wavelength at that operating frequency, let me think about that. Half wavelength, would you still be launching very much current? I think the answer is no. There's very few circumstances where you mount that poor man's balun something like 10 feet away that's going to give you any grief. In the ideal world, you're mounting it right at the antenna. But 10 feet away at most of your bands, I think it's going to work like a charm. And there's ways you can run some tests to find out if it's doing what you want it to do and modify it afterwards. I mean, just because you've set it up a particular way, I mean, almost all of our antennas that we amateurs use really is a kind of an experiment. I used to use a dipole, now I'm using a vertical ground plane. It's a half wavelength long, and I'm comparing the results I get today versus the results I used to get. So almost all of our antennas are a kind of an experiment. Very rarely do we set up an antenna and use the exact same antenna for the next 10 years, if you know what I mean. An active amateur is making some kind of a change to his antenna every few months, I think. Over to you, Phil, K2RIW.
Yeah, KB2DXC. Well, I've done many antenna changes over the years. I mostly like working with wire antenna. You get creative with that. And this is just another installation I want to do. I've got one of those rigid rotatable dipoles that do, you know, five bands, but every so often got to go up there and, like, you know, twist the elements and get the oxidation off the connections and things, and it just plain looks ugly. And how many ham operators say that their antennas look ugly? I'm probably the only one. But this one just needs to go, and I want to just play with wire antenna with that. Just to wrap it up, just one last thing is, in terms of ground, I know you said really you might not need, don't need counterpoises. If I got a vent pipe, I don't know if wrought iron will really do, I might have some access to that. But when discussing ground and antennas and wavelengths above ground, where is ground to an antenna that's five stories up in the air on top of an apartment building? K2RIW, KB2DXC.
There's a ridiculously high percentage of ham radio operators who believe there must be a grounding system nearby to an antenna for it to work well. In many cases, that is not true. Picture an astronaut floating in free space. He's in orbit. He's 100 yards. He's floating behind the space shuttle. He's 100 yards behind it. And in front of him is a full half-wave dipole, electronically a half-wave. He's got a small transistorized transmitter. He's running QRP, and he's feeding that dipole. He's 200 miles above Earth. Where is the local ground? That antenna doesn't require ground. It's a balanced structure. On the first half cycle, he's feeding current, positive voltage into the right-hand side of the dipole and negative voltage into the left-hand side. And the next half cycle, he's doing the opposite. So his feeding system in the middle of that dipole is pumping current from the left side toward the right side on the first half cycle, and pumping current from the right side to the left side on the second half cycle. That works like a charm. So that kind of an antenna requires no ground. If you are mounting a quarter wave or vertical ground plane antenna, let me drop for a second. It turns out that a dipole antenna really is a pair of ground plane antennas, quarter wave ground planes, back to back. I could take that half wave dipole in free space. I could mount a sheet of metal right in the middle of it at right angles to the wire. And because it's at the neutral plane, right side is positive, left side is negative, during this half cycle, there's a neutral voltage right there in the center. So this infinite sheet of metal at right angles to the wire, right in the center, I put that sheet of metal there. It makes no change to the impedance, the pattern, the efficiency, the radiation characteristics. Nothing changes because I put that sheet of metal there. Somebody realized that that takes place, said that, why don't I just throw away one half of the dipole and feed the remaining half with reference to that sheet of metal, and now the mirror image of the half of dipole that I've got in that sheet of metal gives me the equivalent of the other half. Yes, that works electronically. But now you're mounting, you're pouring a hell of a lot of current from that sheet of metal into the quarter wave. And so the antenna really wants to see an infinite sheet of metal, and that forces you, with a quarter wave ground plane antenna mounted on the Earth, to get a very low impedance to make it act like that sheet of metal. You end up putting down a whole lot of ground plane radials. Let me drop. If you were able to take that quarter wave ground plane antenna, raise it above the ground, and just put one single radial collinear with the radiator and hang it straight down, it's now a half wave antenna, vertically polarized, that'll work like a charm. So one ground plane radial is all you need. That's the other half of the dipole, which is the original antenna. So as you can see, a vertical ground plane antenna really is only half of the dipole, and it requires heroic effort to make that work efficiently, to have it high enough above the Earth, to have a big enough counterpoise. The best counterpoise in the world is the other half of the dipole, if you know what I mean. So many antennas, because of what their operation is like, require no local ground of any kind. Let me drop. So the word ground is not required in order to get radiation. That's a highly misunderstood area. The ground may only be required in order to create a counterpoise for the other half of the antenna that you've decided not to put there. If it's a balanced antenna and you're feeding it in the center, no ground is required. So loops and dipoles and quarter reflectors and parabolic dishes, there's a whole of the 5,000 kinds of antennas, a significant number of them require no local ground. The local ground is only required if you've decided to feed half an antenna, so to speak. And the galvanized pipe, that's the vent pipe that's on that roof, that could be a very good counterpoise if you're feeding the open end, the outer end of a half wavelength electronic radiator. Over to you, Phil, KQRIW.
KQRIW, KB2DXC. Okay, I'm feeling a lot better about what I can do with the antennas at this point because there's just been so many people stressing having a proper ground, and all the readings I've done about these end feds and off-center fed antennas. There's a lot of different opinions, as many opinions as there are antennas. And again, my situation, not necessarily unique. I'm sure there are others that are, you know, cliff dwellers or cave dwellers, whatever they call us in apartment buildings. I got the height, it's great. I've used other antennas that without radials, any kind of a ground, and I've really had no issue here. The current mounts that I use are on vent pipes. I don't know if those things are cast iron or wrought iron. I don't know if that's going to give me any kind of a ground, but I'm okay, and I'm not using the radios. I just disconnect near the coax, and that's just another safety thing for me. I know I've kind of monopolized this for a little bit now. It's been about 20 minutes, so Dick, I thank you very much for all the answers. I think I know where I have to go as far as any further research. K2RW, KB2DXC.
Yeah, your galvanized vent pipe, if you required it to give you a 1-ohm impedance because of your particular antenna design's requirement, that might be difficult. But if you only need a couple of 100 ohms of impedance on it, because you're feeding a 2,000-ohm outer tip of an antenna that's half wavelength electronically, then it would be hard to find a grounding structure that wouldn't be more than sufficient. So that gives you one hell of an advantage from my point of view. Now, the word ground does have a couple of other meanings. We like to ground our equipment for human safety to make sure that we don't... to make sure that we don't have a problem with a hot chassis where some kind of wiring error has occurred between you and Loco or Con Ed, if you know what I mean. So grounding for reasons of human safety and lightning protection, that's entirely different. But you and I right now are discussing grounding requirements in order to make efficient radiation. Does somebody want to give us some further comments on this? Please give us your call letters and name right now. K2RIW and the TechNet.
Dick.
Go right ahead, Rich.
Yes, I was away from the mic, but I heard a lot. Coax with a baron is not the best choice. You know what I'm going to say? A zip. They use them in the 30s, and they're good now. You just feed it with open wire line.
Yeah, what Rich is referring to is that... he had, I think it was an 80-meter dipole, and he wanted to operate it on 40 meters or 40, I think it was a 40-meter dipole, and he wanted to operate it on 80 meters. But what I'm getting at is that a dipole being fed on the wrong band can give you an extremely high standing wave ratio. And coax cable running into an extremely high standing wave ratio, even if you've got an antenna tuner in the shack that has enough dynamic range, it can handle it. You're going to end up with a hell of a lot of extra loss of the transmission line. So if you're trying to feed an antenna on the wrong band, 40-meter dipole being fed on 80 meters or vice versa, then the only way you can make that work well is for an extremely low loss transmission line. An open wire line can do that for you. But because your antenna, you know the physical length, you know its electrical length, you can calculate what the impedance is going to be. You can calculate what the standing wave ratio is going to be. and therefore you know that if the standing wave ratio is going to be very high and you're going to get a lot of loss in the transmission line, it doesn't take rocket science to build the right kind of an LC network at the antenna that corrects that impedance to make it more amenable to your 50-ohm coax, so to speak. So there's ways of eliminating the problem at the source. A brute force approach is open wire line.